Now, if you just take my lead and follow with your guitar playing along with me, and don't try to play faster and don't play slower, just come in with me as close as you possibly can. Let the rhythm just sort of push the thing along. Just easy like. Very easy. Very easy going. Just take my lead and follow with your guitar playing along with me. Don't try to play faster and don't play slower. Come with me as close as you possibly can. Let the rhythm just sort of push the thing along. Easy like. Very easy. Very easy for me. Yes, good. And all kinds of things. Any jazz. And finger twists. Going up and down the streets. Now just drop out one by one. Drop through the room out, and listen to the group as you drop out. See the space left where you were playing. Just keep it easy going. Very easy. And just kind of smooth. Fine. And wonderful. And just keep drifting away. And drifting back and back and back and back. Now, if you just take my lead and follow with your guitar.
I don't know what this is.
Along with me.
We heard the X and Han Benning. Prism song taken from a great double live LP coming out of KFJC, our friends to the west. KFJC 50.
Close.
Blowing minds since 1959. Live music performed on that radio station. Exiles from Clown Town, a 7-inch called Around the Corner. We heard the track Whistling Assassins. Another 7-inch from Berliner Eins before that, Smile Like a Sinner. And yet another one. Master musician, Sore Eros, new 7-inch called Tall Compass. That's what we heard, the A-side. Master musicians of Bukaki from Totem 2, we heard Coincidentia Oppositorum. Robert Wyatt did Marianne from Schleep, Fat Chance to Dream. Cicos Amoyados, lead off cut from the first self-titled album, Sangue Latino, name of the song. Dorothy L'Amour sang Perfidia from a nice compilation of Hollywood singing. Morphle Tang opened that set, track 5 from Heard and Unheard. That's everything we heard. My name is Scott. I will see you next week. Stay tuned for Benjamin Walker's Too Much Information. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange. WMFU Mount Hope Worldwide, WFMU.org. See you next week.
All brands are trying to take advantage of social media, and they want to put their brand out there and have people interact and react to it. So they want ideas. They want lots of ideas.
Philip is an ad man. He works on campaigns for some of the world's largest brands. One of his clients, a giant tobacco company, he says, is especially eager to hop on the social media bandwagon.
So we have a relatively new client on the team, but he's been with the company for a long time, and I went down to meet with him for the first time. His name is Dwight, and he has
sort of a raspy voice, and he's talking about, you know, his long storied career with the company, and he needs to come up with some new ideas for this kind of new media space.
And I'm like, oh, well, you know, what's your background? What have you done?
I've spent lots of years in product development, and now I'm moving into something new, so I'm hoping that it's going to work. And I think it should be social media. We need to get the brands onto social media.
I'm like, okay, we can definitely think of some ideas. So we flew down for our big presentation to North Carolina to meet with him and tell him about some of our ideas for a Facebook page. None of these ideas we really believed in, because we knew fundamentally we couldn't have the brand out there for people to interact with. Tobacco companies want to target their messages only to consumers, adults, who have raised their hands, say that they are consumers of tobacco products and that they want to receive these advertising messages. So the problem with social media is that there's a disconnect, that that anyone's out there to see the message that you're putting forth. It's not limited in any way to just those consumers that you're trying to target with your one-to-one messaging. But we had to do this because Dwight was, you know, wanting some social media ideas, because social media is the future and everybody's doing it. All brands are doing it. So there we were. So the presentation goes, you know, we sort of play out how the brand could appear in social media, and he's commenting favorably on the presentation, and then it goes to the higher level of his boss for a review of the idea, and she's absolutely having no part of it. It does not fit any of the guidelines of responsible marketing. We can't have the brand out there being exposed to children or whoever happens to surf by this page on Facebook, and just completely rip them a new one. I was hoping that this would be the end of social media and we could put this aside and sort of focus on the regular marketing programs that we use, but she had an idea. And that idea was, why not create our own community? Behind the age verification and gated walls that are our website, and, you know, create a community that people can exchange ideas and talk about the brand. And
like Smokebook.
Exactly, Smokebook. We could call it Smokebook. That's good. So we had to retreat back to New York and come up with ideas related to Smokebook. How could that, a community for smokers, targeted to smokers, and only able to be accessed by smokers, how would that work online? So we come together with our ideas, and, you know, it's just a full-featured community with messaging and email and, you know, commenting and walls and those types of things. But we know only people who are age verified and raise their hands to receive information are allowed into this gated community. And there they can freely express their ideas about the product, the brand, smoking, whatever it may be. So we present those ideas. Very well received by Dwight. He's excited.
This is a great idea. I think this is exactly, it fits the guidelines of responsible marketing. It'll do great things for the brand.
His boss also excited her idea. She went, it's good, 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 good. There was another layer in that meeting, and that boss is like, absolutely not. We are not creating a forum for people to freely give us their ideas or their comments or their free-form text on this website. It's absolutely not going to work. People could say, you know, smoking is bad for you, right? People could say, this brand sucks, you know, things like that. We just don't want to have any, they don't want to be responsible for having to vet through those comments. which is saying they absolutely don't want to be in the social media space at all, right? This is what I've been thinking the whole time. This is why it's so frustrating to have to go back week after week with these ideas for something that's not going to fly. It's just patently broken. The idea is bad to begin with. Dwight desperately tries to salvage the idea, right? Like, you know, this is, his career is based on this. So he's like,
perhaps we could, instead of like freeform text, they could just use, you know, drop-down menus to comment on what they want to. So it would be a community, but, you know, it would be, you know, a more structured community.
Huh. Luckily that didn't move forward. So finally, I think we're done with this social media idea that we don't need to pursue this any further. But the boss, the senior boss in the room who was shooting this idea, came up with another idea. Just like, I think we need an app. We need to do an app. Everyone has an app. All brands have an app. It's time for this brand to have an app. So it's back to New York to try to flesh out this idea, which I know will be killed once we go back down to present it. For, you know, no reason other than the fact that in an app store, you can freely comment on the app and they'll have to deal with that user-generated content that they're so averse to. And hopefully at that meeting, there'll be another boss, another layer that comes in and finally puts the kibosh on some social media and tobacco.
Eventually, Big Tobacco is going to figure out how to make social media and mobile apps work, because the future of mobile advertising is going to be huge, and no one wants to be left out. Recently, both Twitter and Apple have announced their plans for mobile advertising. Apple's is, of course, called iAds. And according to PC Magazine's Lance Ulanoff, these iAds might turn out to be more significant than their latest iToy, the iPad.
The time is certainly right for Apple to get into the mobile ad space with iAds, and that's really what this is all about. Everybody wants a piece of the mobile pie because it's the fastest growing market. Everybody has a mobile device. Everybody's staring at it all day long, but no one has really solved the mobile ad conundrum.
That conundrum is, of course, how to force people to interact with mobile advertising and make bazillions of dollars. But will Apple succeed where so many others have failed?
You know, Apple has this habit of getting into things and telling you how they should be done. You know, they don't necessarily look around and see how everybody else is doing stuff and say, you know what, that looks pretty good. Let's get in and do things either similarly or with a slight variation on a theme. No, they get in and they say, hey, you're going to like mobile ads that are like this. That are replicating the experience you might have had when watching television, seeming to disregard the fact that we've worked for years now to not have to see television commercials. Thank you very much, TiVo and all of our DVRs. We're skimming right by them.
Lance believes that Apple is going to bake the ads directly into the apps. So you might be standing on a street corner looking for a Japanese restaurant using Yelp, when suddenly an ad for Starbucks will blare at you from your phone asking you if you'd like to take a caffeine quiz.
Oh, you would see people standing on the street shaking their phones. They'd be so angry. They'd be just like shaking it, staring at it, getting red in the face, going, where is my Yelp? What is this ad? I'm not looking for Starbucks. Why do they think I'm doing that? Yeah, there's a Starbucks here, but that's not what I was interested in. Don't take me in this whole experience where I can play the whose caffeine is stronger game. I don't want to do that.
I've always thought that Philip K. Dick had imagined the worst possible future of advertising. In a few of his books, there are these robot advertising billboards that literally can follow you off the street into your apartment, harassing you about what you should buy. And you can go to jail if you even push them away from you. But the idea of my phone going off every few minutes telling me to play some coupon quiz actually seems worse. And Apple is not the only company working on this sort of thing. Intrusive ads will soon start showing up in your Twitter feed as well. Erica Naone writes for MIT's Technology Review.
The first phase is that Twitter is going to change its search page to let promoted tweets appear at the top of that page. So this is going to be familiar to people because it's going to look a lot like what you see when you go to Google. So you're going to see a sponsored tweet, promoted tweet, right at the top of the page when you search for a term that an advertiser has purchased.
This is called contextual advertising. You see ads or an offer based on what the ad bots presume you might be wanting at that moment. Google has made billions of dollars implementing this technology. But Twitter wants to get right up in your face, like Apple plans to do.
In a later phase, they've talked about at least putting promoted tweets into a user's timeline. That means that when I am just interacting with people, having a conversation, reading posts, I might see a tweet from a company that I don't follow just because the algorithms have determined that that fits in with what I'm talking about or what I'm interested in. The accuracy of their targeting algorithms, because they're going to be putting it in the stream that I'm looking at all day long. What'll be annoying is if they get their targeting wrong and hit some kind of uncanny valley so that I'm getting ads that maybe I can see how they would work for me, but they really don't make sense. For example, I write a lot about software, but I'm not a software developer. So if I start getting ads that are geared specifically towards software developers, I would be irritated. And I think that's the type of mistake that it's easy to make when you have imperfect targeting algorithms.
Now, there is no question that they're going to get this wrong. Google gets it wrong all the time, and they have entire emails to feed to their algorithms. But in Twitter, we're talking 140 characters, so it's even easier to get wrong.
Your mobile device is with you wherever you go. Oftentimes when you're out and about, you're buying things. So having that assist with localized deals, relevant commerce links, you know, for your location, for what you're shopping for, that's going to be seen as tremendously beneficial by consumers.
Now, let's say they could get it right. Let's say I write a tweet that says, I'm the mayor of my air mattress. And then Twitter correctly deduces that I need to buy a new bed. And so they send me a bunch of ads for Sleepies and the Mattress Factory. Let's say they can take my tweet and figure out that I'm actually ashamed at how squalid my apartment's become because I work all the time. And so they send me some more ads for local maid services. Let's say their algorithms are so good that they can even tell the subtext of my tweet that I feel lost and alone in the world. And they send me some more ads or free trial coupons for an online escort service. Well, I don't want ads to tell me what I really need or truly desire. I will stick to the lonely air mattress. For me, the problem is not how accurate these ad bots are going to be, but how intrusive Apple and Twitter want their ads to be. I don't have a problem with the ads on Google and Facebook because, like many of my friends, I've trained myself to ignore them. But Lance Ulanoff says folks like me are out of luck because mobile advertisers are going to change the game and swap out the word intrusive for helpful.
I think that to be a part of the mobile game, you will have to accept the fact that ads will in some way be part of it.
Now, if you don't find ads helpful, you can block them online. There's even a simple Firefox extension called AdBlock. It's easy to install and millions of people use it. But a growing number of websites are starting to push back. Recently, a website called The Escapist banned some of its members for even posting about AdBlock. Some Escapist users were, of course, outraged. They found it insulting that the editors would even dare to presume that users should be forced to see ads. But Ken Fisher, the editor of the technology website Ars Technica, believes this outrage is all one-sided.
I find that there's a certain degree of hypocrisy in the whole dialogue, because I agree with the ad blocking people 100% when they say I have the right to control how information appears on my screen. I don't think that is a point anybody can seriously argue against. So it is totally within their rights, legal or otherwise, ethical or moral, to do that. At the same time, though, I really, really have to strongly object when people come out of the woodwork and say that websites don't have the right to try and block readers or ban readers for exercising that right.
Back in March, Ken Fisher ran an experiment on Ars Technica. He tricked Adblock into blocking content along with advertising, so a number of articles were rendered invisible to his tech-savvy readers. Fisher says he did this to make his point that Adblock software hurts his business.
You know, people talk a lot about the death of newspapers and the death of traditional journalism, and in very much this is all tied to this question of revenue. And consumers have to realize that you really can't have your cake and eat it too. It may be the case that you can today, but the logical conclusion of everyone blocking these kinds of advertisement-based businesses is that those businesses and their content vanishes. Now, there are plenty of people out there who will say, good riddance. But, you know, especially in the journalism world, I think that's a pretty terrifying prospect. I mean, right now, if I think about who is really doing very important long-term investigative reporting, that's still being pretty much shouldered by the mainstream media. You know, it's great that Gizmodo can, you know, find somebody to hand them over an iPhone 4 that they found in a bar, but let's not kid ourselves.
Fisher conducted his experiment on a Friday night when web traffic is typically low, but the response was immediate and deafening. Many of his readers accused him of trying to change the rules of the internet. Fisher says this kind of talk drives him crazy, especially when commenters tell him the problem is his business model.
You know, my message to the people who are like, you know, well, maybe you need to switch business models is like, look, the minute somebody shows me a business model that is going to do better than the one we've got right now, the minute I switch.
Perhaps the most effective way of delivering online advertising, if we follow Ken Fisher's line of thinking to its logical conclusion, is locking down the entire content delivery mechanism, tricking the end user into consuming advertising along with content. And this is what some fear Apple and Twitter are going to do. But Fisher believes these closed platforms will also fail if they don't deal with the real problem, bad ads.
The strength of those things is going to really be determined in part by just how cognizant they are of their readers and their readers' tolerance for, you know, certain kinds of advertising. If you decide I'm going to live in the Apple iPad ecosystem and I'm going to have these Apple ads served to me in this control platform that I can't block these ads for, if those ads are over the top, if those ads get to be too much, people are going to vote with their feet. You know, it's the reason why people block ads is because they find them insulting.
Yeah, they suck. I mean, it's perfectly reasonable. I mean, they're awful. They're mm-hmm. awful.
It's beyond ridiculous at this stage. The only way I think the media is going to be able to kind of keep this going is to be a leader in having really frank conversation with marketers, with clients, with, you know, with the people that are doing these ads and saying, look, you know, you've got to stop treating everybody like they were born yesterday with your ads.
I think Fisher's going to have to wait a long time, though, if he thinks that the problem of bad ads can be solved by the industry that makes them, because those people are f***ing nuts.
Advertising is nothing if not totally irrational.
Steven Stein is more famous for his music than his ad work, but he did time in the business, working for some of the major agencies. Work, he says, drove him crazy.
I went nuts when I was working as a freelancer and as a staff writer, because I don't really have the accommodating nature that you need to be dealing with, you know, basically stupid people who are telling you irrational things. It's the most irrational business. You know, I mean, everything from when I worked at a large agency to have an account guy come in, plunk down in your office and say, I presented your work to the client. You go, oh, so Joey, how did it go? But it went great, man. They loved everything. They only had one comment. What was that? They hated everything. You know, and it's very much like that. It's always the first thing is, we want to do a spot for this, except you can't mention the product or you can't mention the major attribute. You know, and so, you know, and this is why people in advertising get ulcers.
Steven Stein says he still does occasional ad work. Recently, he signed on to do a radio spot for a medical marijuana shop in Boulder, Colorado. But he discovered that there were rules against using the word marijuana in the ad. And that wasn't the only word that was verboten.
Pot, cannabis, weed, herb, green, kinds, which I've never heard. Kibbs, which I've never heard. Kibbids, which I've never heard. Schwag, which I've heard in a different contest. Schwigs. I mean, I don't know. You know, I may have aged out of the demographic or slang in marijuana, but I didn't know half of this stuff. Pot, Mary J, Mary Jane, yes. Herbage, KG, got me. Chronic, yes. Spliff, blunt, ganja, sensei, sensimilla, mata, which is like from the 30s or 40s. THC, Buddha, grass, reefer, shake, bud, hemp, dope, draw, do. Draw, I've heard only in European contexts. Endo, I don't know about. Gigglebush. I can't imagine a radio commercial that referenced the words gigglebush in any way. I mean, that's just so wild. Purple Haze, which is a brand name, not a generic. Matchbox. Meso roll, which is obviously some sort of a corruption of Mesorol, which came from Mesro. Mo, which I've never heard in this context. Mighty Mez, which I have. Kush and Hydro. Unbelievable. We'll take your money for the advertising, but you can't mention the word.
Now, when it comes to crazy or intrusive ads, you don't have to just sit there and take it. In fact, there are brave men and women who've been standing up to advertising and doing something about it for decades now. Men like Jack Napier of the Billboard Liberation Front.
We are not against billboards. We like billboards. We support billboards. We think billboards are wonderful. We think that everyone should have a billboard. Cities are places for loud conversation, for big lights, for colorful exchanges, and so we're all for it. The only thing that we really debate is the relatively small cabal of companies that control these giant canvases for messaging. We think that everyone should access them, and that's our mission statement, if you want to call it that, is to encourage everyone to go out and use these canvases that we believe are common property. They can't escape them, so they ought to be able to be part of the dialogue that takes place on these giant advertising canvases.
One of the most egregious polluters of public space is McDonald's. And so for Ronald McDonald's 50th birthday, the Billboard Liberation Front decided to put up its own ad, a birthday card spoof of sorts, one that utilized the classic sci-fi scenario of aliens fattening up humans for future consumption.
So we came up with a backboard idea for an image, and we decided on a giant, scary-looking alien like Ronald McDonald, who's a 7-foot figure with a mechanical arm with a giant hamburger in it. Oh, we also made a corpulent kid kneeling with his mouth open in front of him so that Ronald McDonald's arm would push his hamburger on Ronald's hand into the kid's face over and over and over again. And then his backdrop is a giant alien, big, fat, you know, ugly purple alien in profile staring across at a big, fat, ugly, weird, like, alien like Ronald McDonald. And in between them is a huge, you know, M archway, and then the caption, "To serve man." So that was a finished image. We chose a location that I really liked, which is a giant billboard across from the McDonald's in the Haight-Ashbury right at the Golden Gate Park, which is a very high-volume McDonald's. And the billboard was facing the McDonald's store about 100 yards away. And we did the billboard in broad daylight, Memorial Day, you know, with the license plates changed and with the magnetic stickers on the site calling out Viacom, because that was the company that owned the billboard. And we ended up with 30 or 40 people dressed up as Ronald McDonald and several hamburglers. And these folks, their job was to kind of draw the attention away from the people on the billboard. And anybody who's in the neighborhood noticed all these Ronalds, I mean, we're paying no attention to what looked like a standard billboard crew on a billboard. We were pretty much invisible. So we finished, put out the animatronic figures and clamped them out with C-clamps, and then drove away as quickly as we could. The police pulled in the lot about 2 minutes after we finished. And we went around the corner and got into our own Ronald McDonald costumes and joined the melee of Ronald's, and we celebrated Ronald McDonald's 50th birthday that way. We really analyzed it from an economic point of view. We probably not only don't hurt the capital interests of these companies that we're altering or improving the billboards for, we probably actually help them sell more product than they would if we weren't doing what we're doing, because we get them more attention. Any exposure is good exposure for your product. They understand that because that's their business. Also, considering the fact that we don't damage the underlying billboard, and members of the outdoor advertising industry are quoted in the press saying that. So I think that went to court, hopefully it would be to our advantage. We also leave good bottles of scotch for the sign workers for when they come up to restore the billboard to their original messages. We leave a little note for them, thanking them for their efforts. Advertising literally is the language of our culture. We're trying to communicate the idea that people can seize the means of communication, and it will make them more alive to do that. And we encourage that on all levels, including people we don't agree with. I mean, I'm perfectly happy seeing, you know, right-wing wackos and left-wing wackos both have their own billboards, and everybody in between, and preferably in neon.
I think the scariest thing I ever heard about advertising was that one day there would be ads in space. Nike swooshes, Coke banners, and McDonald's arches all up there with the Big Dipper and the Great Bear. To tell you the truth, I'm actually surprised it never happened. I'm surprised it actually never happened. But there is a very real story about advertising in outer space. In her new book, Another Science Fiction, author Megan Prelinger shows how the ads that appeared in industry trade journals like Missiles and Rockets from 1957 to 1962 helped America create the aerospace industry and win the space race. These ads are way more fiction than science, though. They show exploding space stations, lunar unicycles, and butterfly-shaped spaceships.
This is a picture of a ship, an imagined spaceship called the Cosmic Butterfly. It is butterfly-shaped with a central insect-like body and then wings of these arrays of ion cells. The artist Frank Tinsley has elaborated on the idea of a single ion cell drive and has webbed together these wings of ion cells to create this fantasy spaceship called the Cosmic Butterfly.
The artist Frank Tinsley was well known for his work in pulp magazines like Amazing Stories. And before 1957, his fantastic drawings would have been out of place in the pages of trade journals like Aviation Week. But in 1957, the Soviet Union launched Sputnik, and of course, everything changed.
Before 1957, the idea of that we would take our technology and use it for a kind of civil space program that would absorb the excitement generated by science fiction, it was a little too abstract before Sputnik. And then with Sputnik, that was kind of like a shock to the system that I think inspired something like a marriage or a confluence between the excitement around science fiction and the real-world emerging technologies that were suddenly jolted to life.
The United States government committed millions of dollars to the space race. It was kind of like the dot-com boom, and the emerging industry needed workers fast. So what these ads were really advertising were jobs.
So the leading purpose of most of these ads was recruitment. Over 500,000 people were hired into the emerging aerospace industry between 1957 and 1962. And most of the ads were really targeted at people who were not quite inside the industry yet, but were looking in and seeking to imagine themselves within industry. And a lot of the creative visualization behind the images was intended to feed the idea that people could find a new job there and play a role in not just, you know, building a navigation system for a missile, but being part of a greater plan that would someday carry us all the way to Mars.
These ads were not just aimed at the starry-eyed engineers of the future, though. They were also geared to grab the attention of the men holding the large government checkbooks, like this one, for all-metal self-locking bolts from K-Lock.
The ad is like one side. It's just plain copy and photo reel pictures of bolts. And the right side is this fantastically excited reaching hand, reaching for the moon with a rocket inset within the hand. And it's this kind of juxtaposition of nuts and bolts, but nuts and bolts, we've got to believe they're going to get us to the moon. I mean, a lot of these ads, they were actually advertising nuts and bolts to industry, and they want to make sure their nuts and bolts are included in the spacecraft that are going to go to the moon.
Prelinger says she's spoken to a few former engineers who recall some of the ads in her book and the letdown they felt when they discovered they'd be designing bolts rather than spaceships. But how could they not feel let down? Bolts are not as cool as the ion cell butterfly ship. But even though the stuff in these ads never got built, Prelinger believes these ads showcase the power of the American imagination and the role it played in the creation of our space industry.
The ads express a period in time when there was a loose association between design and technology, because people didn't know what the machines were going to turn out to look like yet. A lot of things were visualized in the sense of imagination, but they couldn't quite be visualized in a material way. So people used the visual languages of imagination to depict what they might look like. What might it look like to have a lunar lander? What might it look like to have an array of espionage and geophysical satellites? People didn't yet know that in 1957, so they drew on these kind of visual themes from science fiction illustration to depict this kind of exciting tension between creative visualization and real-world emerging technologies. Our relationship between technology and creativity with regards to space has gone a little flat, and it could definitely use some excitement.
Or maybe some more ads. Maybe we just can't make it to Mars unless we get the admin back in the game. Eric Parnes is a New York-based visual artist who often turns to current events for inspiration. One day, he came across an article about Western franchises in the Middle East.
McDonald's, of course, Starbucks, Domino's, Subway, Hardee's, you know, Applebee's, TGI Fridays, all of these things. Cheesecake Factory.
All of these chains can be found in the Middle East. Saudi Arabia, Dubai, the new Iraq, but you won't find them in Iran, because it is, of course, illegal for American companies to do business there. But Eric, whose family is from Iran, found himself imagining what it would look like if there were actual giant McDonald's signs in Tehran.
In this particular painting, I have a McDonald's sign, which is obviously widely known throughout the world. You can't miss it. And it's juxtaposed with like a minaret of a mosque in the background. And it's sort of this idea of how advertising and Western companies would interface with the religious aspects in Iran and what their appeal would be. And if there, in fact, would be some sort of, you know, obvious discourse between the two.
When I look at these paintings of women in veils going into KFC or Arab children outside a Starbucks or a giant McDonald's sign towering over the mosques of Tehran, I can't help but see cultural imperialism. Perhaps this is just because I read too many issues of Adbusters in the 1990s, but for Eric, this might just be the path to opening a dialogue with Iran.
If, in fact, Iran and the United States were on better terms, you would most likely see something similar, of course, going on in Iran. And it's just kind of like the play off of, because we here, you know, assume it's impossible to have, you know, to have, again, a coexistence of like Starbucks with, you know, women wearing a chador, which is the full outfit that covers the head and the body. Here, and you know, it seems like there's a great disconnect as far as like consumerism and Western culture, and then, you know, the Islamic Republic, for example. But, you know, I think it actually illustrates something that exists in Iran, which is already sort of a strange, you know, balance and dichotomy that's already there as far as, you know, how they try to enact this, you know, Islamic world, and yet at the same time do it in a way that can't escape the influences around it. So for me, it's sort of just like, it's like a hyper extension of what on some level already exists. And I think that even if things were to move in a different direction, let's say positive relationship with Iran, that you would see this and would no longer become sort of hyper, but almost normal.
As much as I like Eric's fantastic paintings, it's really difficult for me to see a giant McDonald's sign as proof of cultural dialogue. But the source materials for his paintings are real fast food chains in the Muslim world, which means, I guess, that religious intolerance and advertising are not incompatible. Before there was the internet, one of the things I cared about the most was living in a world with no ads. I know that might sound quaint today or make me sound incredibly old, but it's true. I wanted to live in a world without billboards, a world without underwriting on public radio, a world where non-commercial actually meant non-commercial. Perhaps it was because I was living in Montana, but I really did believe a world like this was possible. Also, I was reading a lot of Adbusters magazine. Adbusters was kind of like a Bible for me. This magazine even inspired my friend Charlie and I to saw down a real billboard and set it on fire. Well, okay, we were kind of drunk, and that might have had something to do with it as well. But what I liked about Adbusters magazine was their commitment to the idea that we didn't have to compromise with advertising, that we could collectively stand up and say, hell no. And I wasn't the only person to take inspiration from this magazine. Naomi Klein's No Logo also springs from its pages. So my original idea for this radio show was to explore how we went from Adbusters to AdSense. Today, Google's online advertising program is pretty much ubiquitous. And as you've heard from most of the people on the show, there's more to come. Not only are attitudes to advertising changing, but the very architecture of the internet is changing too. And it's all being done in the interest of advertising. This kind of makes me want to saw my own head off, because it seems that in the future, people like me who want to live in a world without ads will at best be considered kooks and, worst case scenario, criminals. But what if my problem is just that I read the wrong magazine? What if I simply filled my head with bad ideas? I do know a ton of smart people who can deal with advertising. Some of them, like Matt Howie, editor of Metafilter, have even built awesome, successful businesses using ads.
I'm Matt Howie. I live outside of Portland, Oregon, and I started Metafilter, one of the first weblog communities online. There's about 50,000 people have signed up in the last 10 years, and about 15,000 of those are active in any 1 week. Even though we're small-ish in terms of giant communities on the web, we have 2 full-time moderators, and I also spend most of my time moderating. So we put a ton of effort into making it some place where useful information goes back and forth and interesting websites are shared and questions get answered and things like that. So I started Metafilter in 99 and never really had any sort of commercial aspirations for it. And sometime around 2001 or so after the crash, I was like getting fired from dot-com jobs, let go and stuff as the funding was running out. I kind of did entertain notions of like, God, it would be nice to like get paid for this thing I'm obsessively having to do like 24 hours a day for free. In 2003, Google launched AdSense, and I first tested it on a PVR blog, which was like this blog I wrote just for friends, sort of like all the tips and tricks about TiVos that I had sort of figured out. And I'd been posting these on my personal blog, and I said, you know, I've got like enough here. I'll just like make a blog about TiVos and like how to crack them open and put in a new hard drive and the new features coming out, because I read all the forums about it. So I did that, made a blog. I mean, this is before sort of niche blogging had come out and been a thing. And I slapped these AdSense ads on it. And I sort of debuted the site, and it got linked everywhere. It's like, wow, this is crazy. Someone made up a niche blog about TiVos. And I made like $100 on the first day, and it just totally blew my mind. And after that, you know, it sort of came down, and it was sort of like making several hundred dollars every month as I was like just making a post a day, maybe at the most, about, you know, some sort of TiVo news. And then from there, I added the ads to Metafilter, and it just sort of eventually traffic built up, and, you know, the number of threads and discussions on Metafilter build up to the point now where there's like 500,000 discussion threads, and we were over 3 million comments. So there's just, you know, hundreds of thousands of pages on the site, and like they end up in Google, and people are searching for any of 500,000 different topics. So the site does really well now. We're talking like up to 18 million page views a month. So, you know, even making pennies per page view, you know, that all adds up to thousands of dollars a month. So it's turned into like a really big thing. It's big enough to where I have 3 employees along with myself, and sort of like I had to create a corporation around this to handle all the revenue and income and paying people and paying healthcare and doing all sorts of things like that. I should preface this with saying that, like, I didn't quit my day job until 2005, so 6 years after I started Metafilter, I started to make enough money to, you know, surpass my day job. This is a slow burn, and it's not something you can just sort of start overnight and expect to reap the benefits of advertising. I eventually turned off all advertising for members of the site, and it was just subjecting outside people to the ads. And I've always tried to do that in, like, a tasteful way. We don't do that much tweaking. I mean, you can go insane, you know, tracking analytics and metrics and trying to eke out the most you can from your numbers. For the most part, we just sort of decide where to put ads and what they're going to look like, display them, and then kind of let them be. Once every few months, we might run some sporadic testing to see if this does better than that, and we'll just do some sort of background testing for a day of like send half the traffic to a new version versus the old one and compare. But for the most part, yeah, it's not something I think about or work on a ton. You could argue, I would argue that Google's version of advertising is kind of useful. I mean, it's still there and it's kind of annoying, but I myself have clicked on the ads when it's more useful than the thing I'm reading on the page. So with mobile ads and things like that, if they're like highly targeted, they know what game you're playing or application you're using. If I'm using a, you know, a flight tracker app to figure out if my flight's going to be late, and there's an ad for $59 fares, and it knows which cities I'm flying in, like, you know, like, I think there's, I mean, if you can do innovative ads that can, you know, be relevant to people, that's going to go far, and it's going to actually, you know, not be something that's just purely annoying to people. I'm not a guy who runs like an ad blocker on my browsers, but, you know, I usually just don't go to sites that have really annoying advertising. You know, I can still exist in this day and age, and like there's an acceptable form of amount of advertising to me surfing around.
I'm happy that it all worked out for Matt Howey and everyone else who's living the ad-supported dream. But me? I'm going to hold out for a more attractive model. And in the meantime, I'm going to do my best to not let the advertising tell me what I need or what I desire or drive me insane. Okay, let's end the show with something from TMI contributor Noah Apple. He's got a simple plan to deal with advertising.
My younger sister lives a far more off-the-grid life than me. She lives in Lake Worth, Florida, which is the only town in the country to have an anarchist majority on the city council. It's a kind of paradise of lawn-harvested fruit. They have coconuts, mangoes, tamarind, Suriname cherries, avocados, pomelos. It's all free. They pick it right off the lawn. Her and her partner pay $200 in rent for a house with a backyard where they have chickens and bees and a huge garden and a composting toilet for human manure. They're in this shuffleboard league, and they play ruthless games of shuffleboard with the Cubans and the Jews. Miss Cleo lives 6 blocks away and gives tarot card readings at the lesbian coffee shop for $5. $5! She is this awesome lady, and the last time I saw Miss Cleo, she told me that whenever I see a feather on the ground, I should focus on listening to myself and remember what I need to do to be happy. My sister, in a way, lives like our parents did, but with one major difference. I didn't realize this until a few years ago, but for the first 15 years, my parents were kind of trust fund hippies. Sure, they were raising sheep and making paintings and writing plays up in Maine, but they were also living off interest payments from trust funds. My sister has figured out a way to do this without a trust fund. I have not. I used to dumpster a majority of my food. One thing you can get just about anywhere in the city are unlimited amounts of apples, with one or two bad spots. You cut out the bad spots, and you can make as much applesauce, hard cider, apple crisp, apple tarts, apple pies, apple butter as you want. Same thing with pears. There's always lots of eggplant, sweet potatoes, tomatoes, pizza, bagels, bread. My freezer was always packed to the gills with bagels. But my dumpstering days are in the past. One night, I brought back these sweet potatoes I had harvested from my local trash bank, and... you know, I had been cutting rat bites out of the food for a long time, and I had just considered them, you know, bad spots and tried not to think that I was sharing a meal with a rat. But when my wife saw the rat bites, she didn't want to eat the food anymore. If you're not in the dumpstering zone, or getting that hit of satisfaction that comes with getting something for free, which I think all Americans really enjoy, then the prospect of sharing foods with rats is really hard to ignore. One reason my sister can live so cheaply is she doesn't have health insurance. She feels she doesn't need it. But a few years ago, I noticed that all my biking friends were getting doored. Stitches, broken bones, broken faces. My wife decided I should probably get health insurance. This completely changed the way I live. So for the last few years, I've been living in this strange kind of world where I have three or four jobs running at any time. In any given week or even day, I'm changing out of my painter's whites and into snap-on shirts and clip-on ties for my after-school teaching job. This year alone, I gold-leafed, I painted apartments, I made handmade wallpaper, I taught cooking, math, history, photography, puppetry, and sculpture to grades K through 7, and I was a tomato puppet for NBC. One day, I do hope to live like my sister does, but I'm not moving to Florida, and I still don't have a trust fund. The first step in my plan is to open a one-room schoolhouse in Brooklyn, where I'll be my own boss, I'll have 10 students, teach a bunch of subjects to different age groups, and we'll travel all around the city like the Von Trapps. Except we'll be a junior high school full of Brooklyn doofuses, writing blog entries about our trip to the water filtration plant, and building hydroponic window gardens, and making foam swords, and probably, well, most definitely, there's going to be some making of foam crossbows. I'm going to teach these kids that they don't need to pay attention to all the commercial messages that get jammed down their throat, about what they need to buy and what to be. I mean, kids are bombarded with manipulated messages at a time when they're very vulnerable to suggestion by their peers and rock stars, I mean, even teachers. I'm going to teach these kids how to reimagine the world, how to make their own paths, and how to cut out the bad spots.
This episode of Too Much Information is called Advertising. It was produced by myself, Benjamin Walker, Bill Bowen, Laura Mayer, and Kara Oler. And it featured Philip the Adman, Lance Ulanoff, Erica Naone, Ken Fisher, Steven Stein, Jack Napier, Megan Prelinger, Eric Parnes, and Noah Apple. Special thanks to John Bracken for hooking us up with Philip. You can find all the TMI archives and the TMI podcast on the playlist page. That's at WFMU.org.
Join the host of Too Much Information, Benjamin Walker, at the same time next week. You're listening to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, WFMU.org. Up now, Mud Up with DJ Rupture. Thank you.
tuned into Mud Up here on WFMU 91.1 FM, New York City. And this is Emetsub. Solitude is the name of the song, and the album is The Nothings of the North. Now for some noise. Listening to the work of Israel Martinez, a Mexican composer and sound artist who from Guadalajara, who kicks off the anthology of noise and electronic music, sixth edition, with a pretty amazing piece of, involving all these automobiles being stretched and pulled. Bristol.